Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Off the ball breakfast.
It's funny you have red flags on yourself there, Colin.
I wanted to point that out. Just wanted to say
my red flag for you is that I enjoy hangovers.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
Settle in
on Off the Ball.
It's brought to you by Guinness 0.0.
Ivan is a man who the nation, I guess, would have become familiar with as the fellow who was plucked out of the AIL and helped Leinster to glory last season. Ivan, you're very welcome to the studio.
I really appreciate it.
How are you doing?
Good. I kind of actually be a fairly avid listener of the show anyway, so it's kind of nice to have the shoe on the other foot today and kind of be here and kind of get to chat to yourself, and hopefully the people aren't kind of too sick of listening to me by the end of it.
The Soroka name is continuing in Leinster rugby. I mean, yourself and your brother obviously playing together last year was an amazing thing. Alex isn't having a bad old start to the season.
No, he's been lucky enough. Like, he's like the last kind of 5, 6, 7 months, he's had a good run of it and he's kind of doing quite well, and it's great to kind of see from our end, from like me being his brother and kind of obviously the family kind of looking after him. He would have had a kind of a tough couple of years with a couple of reoccurring knocks and niggles and injuries and stuff, and it was just kind of hard to string him and form together. So kind of when he came back there properly, I think it was January, February last year, he played most of the games in the kind of end of the year kind of running, and then he's had a good start to the season so far and the body's feeling good. So
he's only 24.
He's 24, yeah. He's not 25, he's 6 months, so kind of, yeah, he's gone quite well. Like, he's in a good place over the next few weeks, and just hopefully gets a few more opportunities to kind of show what he can do.
Definitely not a bad result for them on Saturday night either at the Aviva Stadium. I'm keen to kind of tell your story almost from the beginning here, because people might be familiar with it, we might uncover new details today, but there's no debate that it is an amazing story. So you might take us back to the start. You're born in Ukraine. At what stage do you actually move to Ireland as a family?
Yeah, it's a bit of a funny one. So like, my folks would have moved over to Ireland, would have brought me across when I was 6. So I would have been quite young, and I would have come over, and obviously you've got no language, you've got, you know, a brand new friend group, you're kind of going to a new school, new country, new food, new everything. So it was fairly hectic at the start, and I still remember kind of doing English language lessons and stuff with a teacher in primary school. So I would have went in the first or second week of first class, so I didn't actually miss too much. And then kind of as soon as I kind of landed in Ireland, I got into sport, and it was kind of a way I kind of found that was pretty good for me to assimilate and just kind of make friends and make connections. So kind of I actually never touched a rugby ball until I was about 12-13 years of age. Nice. I was in Belleville, so like the parents would have got me into football. They tried to get me to GAA, it wasn't very good, so I tried hurling and GAA for a few months. It just wasn't good, so I kind of knocked that on the head. But it was all kind of tennis, table tennis, swimming, karate, pretty much any sport you could kind of find in the area I was kind of doing. And then I was in primary school in St. Mary's Boys National School in Hennepin Road. And then from there, I would have went into Belvedere College when I was 12. And that's where I kind of started getting into rugby. I had no interest in rugby before I went to school. My parents actually brought me down to Lansdowne a good few times just to see if I'd be interested, watch a bit of training and stuff and see if they'd get me signed up. But I thought it was a horrific sport. Didn't enjoy, didn't like it. That didn't work. As soon as I went to Belvedere, it was no real... Like, football was my main sport, and I was fairly okay at it. And like, a few lads would have been mates with and would have been playing, but be playing League of Ireland or playing over in the UK and stuff now. So like, I ended up getting into Belvedere, ended up starting playing rugby, knocked all the other sports in the head fairly quickly, and that's where the kind of Clontarf connection kind of came about. I did briefly play for Bective at the very kind of start because we live close to it, but then yes. As soon as you're in Belvo, all your mates are from Clontarf, so you're playing with Belvo on a Saturday, you're playing with Clontarf on a Sunday, you're training with Belvo on Monday and Wednesday, you're training with Tarf on a Thursday or Friday. So it was kind of it was a really nice way for me to integrate and make friends and kind of just become kind of part of the community.
It must be one of the unusual facts where you grew up in South Dublin and go to North side for a school.
it was a very strange one. Like, it was funny because like, when I came to Ireland in primary school, I lost obviously all my friends back home. So when the new school, had to make brand new friends, brand new circle, then you're going from the primary school year into secondary school year, and I didn't know a single person going into first year Belvoir. I think we have about 186 odd people in every year, so that was again another start and another challenge. But again, like, I just found sport was the best way to integrate. Like, once you're sporty, once you're going to train, once you go to matches, you'll find that you'll be able to kind of make friends pretty quickly, and then probably makes it a lot easier for your folks and stuff as well to kind of integrate as well. So my friend, like, my family would have an awful lot of friends from kind of the sporting communities would have been a part of growing up.
Were your parents into rugby?
No, my parents were into mad sports. So my mom actually did track and field when she was in school and in college, and my dad, he wasn't into rugby, but he did ice hockey, and he tried football, he wasn't very good at it. Did ice hockey, did boxing, did a few other bits and bobs. So they were both fairly sporty in school and in college, but they never pushed on to anything. They were kind of happy enough just to kind of get working once they kind of finished college. But no, they didn't even know what rugby probably was until they came over here, I'd say.
What drew them away from Ukraine at that point?
It was a tough economic situation. It was it was a little bit before my time, so I kind of go a little bit by hearsay. So yep. It was a tough enough time in terms of after the fall of the Soviet Union. There wasn't a lot of job opportunities or good job opportunities or chances to probably set up a pretty good life for yourself. So they actually ended up moving abroad and then brought me over shortly after. So it was one of those things where they actually initially planned to kind of go fairly short term, and then ended up just loving it and ended up staying and kind of, just due to they've been here for the last, I'd say, 25, 27 years, I think. So they loved Ireland since the first time they actually came here.
When it comes to actually settling in here then and the avenue of rugby, at what point do you start to realise that you're actually bloody good at this thing? Because if you're picking it up late, I presume the first couple of years in Belvedere, you're not exactly best in class at the sport.
Yeah, I still remember my first year. Like, not that I'm very good, or I wasn't very good. It's kind of okay, but like, I remember my first year getting the Most Improved Player Award, which is the award normally goes out to somebody who wasn't very good, but they're still a little bit better than they were at the start of the year. But like, I'd say the first two or three years, you wanted to obviously play well, but you didn't really realise the commitment that it took. And like, when I was coming to the school would have been on riding a real crest of a wave, but kind of the double, they would have won the Junior Cup and Senior Cup a couple of years before that. There would have been some massive up-and-coming talents, and obviously now superstars like the likes of your Keane Healy's, Ian Keatley's, Owen O'Malley's, all these guys that have been playing. The Senior Cup team would have been favourites for the Cup that year, and they ended up actually going on to win it. So you kind of see a lot of that stuff and you kind of imagine yourself in their shoes and you kind of think you might be able to kind of push on. But it wasn't until I was 15 or 16 that I started taking it kind of that seriously. And like, now the way it is now, like, rugby's moved on so much and it's so professional from every single level, you know, from the age of 13-14, people have S&C programs and schools and clubs and nutritional programs and kind of the way they play, all the shapes and stuff you do in training. But it's a case of, like, when I was coming up, it was probably the last year before it went like that. So when I started getting to the gym, like myself, I really didn't have that many resources to kind of tap into. So it was a lot of like kind of, you know, trawling through the internet and kind of looking up different coaches. And I actually got an awful lot of stuff. There was a couple of big NFL S&C coaches that were actually quite good, and they were one of the first ones to start making their stuff public online and YouTube and their websites and stuff. So that's how I kind of got into it. And then kind of, I didn't really make any underage teams until I was kind of actually leaving school. Kind of only after a couple of years of, you know, fairly hard training that you actually ended up getting in the mix a little bit, and it kind of took off a little bit from there. But
Did Alex go to Belvedere as well?
He went to Belvedere, but we were kind of a bit unlucky where we're 6 years apart. So Basically, when I left school, that's when he came in.
But he would have had a totally different experience in terms of the professionalism of coaching in particular that he would have got.
Yeah, 100%. Like, in terms of the coaching setup and everything else that was in place, not just in Belvedere, but pretty much everywhere. Like, obviously, Belvedere was class, but just across the board, the way how much rugby has moved on. And also, he would have been a bit of a freak when he was kind of growing up, when he was born. He would have been absolutely massive as a baby. And he would have obviously been able to kind of stand out an awful lot. He was younger because he looked like he was like 3, 4, 5 years older than everyone else. But then kind of, I'd say, the age of like 14, 15, everyone else got a bit of a growth spurt and he didn't. So he kind of evened out.
Okay.
So he didn't really stand.
He went from second row to back row at that point.
Yeah. And then kind of at that stage then in 15, 16, he got his second spurt and stuff. And he went up to kind of 6'6", or 6'5", whatever he is.
Something ginormous anyway.
Something along those lines anyway. So he kind of would have had a very different experience. And also he would have been kind of lucky enough because he played in Clontarf for 6 years before. He would have actually been going to school knowing an awful lot more of the lads and stuff. So probably would have been a much nicer transition for kind of him. And it kind of thankfully paid off a little bit.
It's really interesting because you're 31, and I was saying off air there's still plenty of years left in the tank for you as a player, and a lot of our peak players in the Ireland team are around the same age as you. And it's interesting to hear that even they haven't got the current version of what's happening in the schools around Ireland, this sort of gilded setup that we have here that is creating a conveyor belt of talent, particularly into the Leinster Academy. It's actually people more of Joe McCarthy's age that are the first wave of players who've actually experienced all of this, which... It's definitely a bit of an exciting thing when you look at the future prospects of Irish rugby.
100%. And it's one of those things where we obviously don't have the same player pool as some of the other nations. So you really kind of probably have to work really hard at what you have. And I was doing about, I did about 3 years coaching when I was in college in Belvedere. And even in just those 3 years to see how much the system and the setup came on from when I left school. And then even with those 3 years, just how much it's moved on. You're probably seeing the rewards of it now. You kind of see how young some of the guys get their runs in the professional game. Obviously, I wasn't really in the game for very long, but kind of even seeing it as an outsider, you're seeing an awful lot more of tight five forwards, especially, you know, kind of making their debuts and getting their first run of games at a much younger age. And they're able to not only fill in, but like actually stand out at the top level. And kind of quite a lot of that, I imagine, has to go back to obviously the schools and the clubs where they get so much training from such a young age.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Center. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Did you move around a few different positions when you were coming through?
Yeah, it was a bit of a mad one. So when I picked up rugby ball, I actually didn't know any rules. I didn't know anything. I didn't know what position to play. They just said, listen, backs and forwards, who's where. Like, you know, kind of the first night, the first morning in Cabra. And I just went with the forwards because I played up front in football. So kind of got myself into that. So I kind of played... I played prop for about a season, even though it was very small. They just kind of chucked me in, throw me in somewhere. But then I would have played hooker and back row in Belvedere. But then, because I played quite a bit of football, I would have had a bit more skills than I have now when I was younger. So it was a case of playing out half, centre, full back for Clontarf. So I kind of played pretty much most positions apart from maybe wing or scrum half. But that was kind of in my younger days when I would have been quite light, fairly quick before I did any kind of gym or any of that stuff. Once you kind of started piling on the pounds, you were moved on into the forwards full time, then you're moved into kind of back row full time, then you're into hooker. And then, you know, my last year, I actually only started playing prop as a sixth year because came back at 110 kilos, having left for summer holidays about 92. So wasn't the best nick, but again, it was a big difference and I couldn't really play anywhere else.
Broad question, but how does Ireland produce better props?
It's a bit of a tricky one. It's probably one of those things, again, like I'm kind of showing my age a little bit. I remember like there was a time where we would have maybe been over reliant on a couple of props, like in the John Hayes and the Marcus Horan days and stuff. But I think it's the fact that like there's so many systems in place and setups in place, not just in Leinster, but all over the country. You're seeing, I'm sure you would have seen Paddy McCarthy do an incredible job on the weekend against the Sharks. And he's probably, 21, 22, 23 years of age, is quite young. And there's an awful lot of other guys like that, you know, your Jack Boyles and the likes that are playing behind your Andrew Porters and Keane Healy, who's retired fairly recently. So, like, it's one of those things where if you compare our prop situation to where we were 10 years ago or 12 years ago when I was in school, it's day and night, and it's in a really good spot across pretty much all provinces. And you kind of think you'll see more and more of that in the coming years. And
Maybe I'm focusing too much on, you know, Porter moving across and Healy playing until he's a million years of age, and it kind of illustrates potentially on one level a lack of depth, but actually you've seen what's actually coming through there's the beginning of something happening there.
It's one of those things, it's always tricky, like, and again, I'm kind of speaking about it as a complete outsider. I've not a professional player, I work a 9-to-5 job, but it's one of those things. It obviously can be hard for coaches and stuff to kind of take chances sometimes in kind of younger players, and you kind of see that yourself as you're kind of coming through and you're seeing other people around you. But it's one of those things that it's very rare when somebody has moved on in the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years that somebody hasn't stepped up.
Yes.
You know, there's probably been a couple of guys that a lot of people might not have heard of or might not have heard of a lot about. and then they get a couple of games at the start of last year, this year, and all of a sudden they're in the mix for Ireland squads and Leinster squads, and they're performing really, really well against, you know, the top international players from all over the world. So it's one of those things. Yeah, it kind of depends, I think, how you look at it. But I don't really remember too many times where over the last couple of years somebody that's a bit older moved on and somebody hasn't stepped up and made a name for themselves over you know, a fairly short period of time, which is again a testament to the work going on in Irish rugby at the moment.
Definitely. So you land as a prop in sixth year. What happens next in terms of your professional ambitions and going in with Leinster?
So kind of fifth and sixth year is when I kind of decided that I really want to actually try and be a professional rugby player. And it's one of those things, you know, it's never really guaranteed. You can kind of do all the things in the world you want and, you know, it may or may not work out. But at kind of fifth and sixth year is when I kind of started knuckling down and would have made a couple of underage teams and stuff at that stage. And you go into kind of the sub-academy / the Irish under-20s kind of mix out of school. And I was kind of hoping to get on the Irish 20s team, and then I was involved in a couple of camps and stuff, and then I just didn't make it. And kind of you kind of think a bit at the time where you start thinking why you didn't make it, and you kind of start thinking of different scenarios, so on and so forth. But like looking back at it 10 years on, you kind of think like maybe you just weren't at that level at that time, which is absolutely perfect once you kind of come to terms with that. Once you're at peace with it, it's kind of absolutely fine. But I would have been, yeah, in the mix coming out of school, thereabouts, would have played Leinster 20s, would have, you know, kind of, we would have won the Interpros that year. A lot of lads moved on to players 20s, and it just didn't happen for me. So what I did was, I just went back to Clontarf, who were just won the AIL that year, their very first one, that was about 12 years ago. And I was kind of going down. I wasn't sure how much game time you kind of get, because they obviously would have won the league the year before. They had an awful lot of front rows that year that were really, really good. I think they still had Tyke Furlong and a few others playing with them that year. I would have just missed them by a few months, and they would have had a couple of really good loose heads and stuff there. But I just wanted to kind of go down and just give myself the best chance. And I thought playing senior rugby, you know, at like 18, 19 years of age, would give me a good chance for that. And then I ended up going down and playing most of the games that year, and we lost the final by a point or two to Lansdowne. And the following year, we actually ended up winning the AIL and ended up getting a trial in Connacht, which was pretty cool. Yeah, it was one of those things that, again, it was kind of a bit of a hit and hope, reaching out to kind of teams and stuff, seeing if they kind of gave me a run. And I had a really good preseason, played a couple of games, and ended up signing my contract. And then the week I signed it, the following week, I blew up my foot in a match. So I tore my lisfranc, which is a nasty enough kind of foot injury. It's a ligament in your foot, which kind of holds all your metatarsals together. So that put me out for 7 months. And then just, I was nearly back from that, and I think in February, I ended up doing my other knee, on the way back. So I missed about 8-9 months that year.
Who was
so
head coach?
That was Pat Lamb's head coach at the time. So that was just the season after they won the, I think it was the Guinness Pro 12, or Pro 14.
So 17
It was 16, 17. So yeah, I ended up playing a game when I came back, but obviously I was going to be let go.
And presumably it was like a one-year contract, right?
Yeah, it was a one-year contract. I didn't really have much of a CV, so it was kind of like I you know, bit their hand off for 1 year contract.
Of course.
I was hoping to come in, do well, and kind of be kept on. But just the way the injuries happened, I, with myself, I didn't get a run. And then when I went back to Dublin, then I moved back home. I kind of was kind of waiting around for a couple of months to see what would come up. And the stuff that was coming up wasn't really tickling my fancy. It just, I didn't really want
to. What are we talking here?
Just like your championship clubs or maybe going over to Italy for not one of the two big teams, but like what I think is the Serie, is it the Serie A it's called or something? With the likes of them.
Off Broadway.
Yeah. And then you have your couple of things coming up with the States and stuff, and I just didn't really fancy it. So I kind of was holding out for something a little bit better and got a job in a bank to just kind of tie me over.
Yeah.
And then I just ended up kind of sticking there. After a couple of months, you kind of go, listen, I kind of, because I went all in out of school, and it didn't work out. And then I went in all in the second time and I moved to Galway, and it didn't work out. And I was kind of thinking, I was like 22, 23 years of age, you're best off kind of going back to playing a bit of club, get a job. If something comes up, great. If it doesn't, you're at least able to kind of build a career. Because with rugby, like, it's, even if you're a top player, you're going to have to get a job at the end of it when it's over.
It's brutal.
It's fairly cutthroat, and it can be brutal. And a lot of time it's out of your hands. So I thought, listen, like, some people start at 30, 32, 35 with their new career. I just have an opportunity to do it when I'm 23. And if something does come up, I'll at least have something to fall back on in terms of kind of the career side of things. So I ended up just kind of staying there ever since.
How big a setback is that for you personally, having to make that decision that professional rugby would have to be parked at that point?
At the time, it was absolutely massive. And it was something I would have been fairly down about. And at the time, it's the be all and end all. And it's the number one thing you want to do, and you spend 5-6 years trying to do it. But then as soon as you kind of get into the swing of things, you get into the swing of every routine of your job, and you actually kind of go from just playing rugby for, you know, trying to make it, actually going back to enjoying it. Probably those year or two coming out of that setup and going back to Clontarf was probably some of the best rugby I ever played. Just because I was actually just enjoying it. There was no pressure. from myself. There was no pressure from anyone else. I was just working 9 to 5. I was training a couple nights a week. I was in the gym, you know, 3 mornings a week. You're doing your video, your analysis, your mobility, your rehab, prehab, all that sort of stuff. But the pressure's kind of off, and then it's a case of you're then in a position where you're just enjoying sport again. You're kind of going back to nearly your under 14, under 15 days in school where you're not thinking about being a rugby player. You're just enjoying playing it. And then the social aspect of it in a club like Clontarf is massive, where you're kind of training with your mates, your family, your friends that are going to the games. You're having a couple of pints after matches and you're actually kind of enjoying everything kind of again, yeah, which was savage.
Had you 100% given up, or is there still 1 or 2% that you're like, if I play well enough this season now, somebody's going to spot me?
With the age now, I'm 99.999%.
No, but I mean back then.
Oh, at that stage? Yeah. At that stage, no. At that stage, I still had a thing where, because I kind of thought I was like, you know, 23, 24, 25. I'm a bit old, but like if something came up, I thought about it. So for the first 2 or 3 years, I was kind of holding out, but then you're kind of weighing up. Once you start working a job, and you start doing exams, you start moving up your career, you're actually starting to earn slightly better money. So then you're kind of like, well, would I walk away from this, you know, to then go back to... So you're kind of weighing things up a little bit there. And I hadn't given up on it fully at that stage, but it was something that I was just... It was kind of in the back of my mind that if something decent came up, I'd jump on it, but it just never really materialized. Like, again, there was a few more bits and pieces, kind of chatting to a few agents and a few people, you know, saying, like, listen, there's something abroad here in, you know, in the UK or something else. Or would you go over in a 3 month, and if it goes well, they'll have a 2 year for you, all that sort of stuff. But you just don't really want to take a risk again. You've kind of been burned twice, but it's something that at the time I wasn't sure about, but looking back on it, it's something that I'm fairly happy with the decision that I made, because it means I'm in a bit more of a secure position at the age of 31 now.
Yeah, it's great. Like, there's not a whole pile of other sports where you can really fill the void with what you had at that point with the AIL. Like, I know obviously you're not getting paid to play rugby full time, and that's obviously a big thing that you almost have to grieve, I'm sure, as a young sportsman. But it's a relatively soft landing, given you do have a good job at that point, and you do have, you know, an outlet for your sport at that point as well.
Yeah, it's like the AIL is a league I personally really like, and I have a massive connection with my family, love it as well. And it's one of those leagues where obviously it's a level down from the professional game. It's a little bit slower. It's a little bit less physical. There's obviously a less training that you do kind of week to week. It's not a professional setup, but in terms of when you look at it, like how it fills your week, it takes up a massive amount of your time, and you're doing as much training as you typically physically can do, given the fact that everyone's either working full time or in college full time or kind of some sort of mixture of both. So like the kind of players you have in there, like you have a lot of guys who might be, you know, your ex-pros, your kind of seasoned kind of professionals. You have a lot of guys that are maybe trying to break through, like maybe I would have been doing in my kind of mid-20s. You have a lot of really young up and coming talents, maybe out of school, maybe lads that are in academies, sub-academies, and then you obviously get your professional players really sort of into kind of every now and then as well. So it's a really good mix. The standard is pretty high. It is tough. You know, when you wake up on a Sunday morning after a big game, you're like, you are in pieces. So it is a tough league to play in. Maybe not in terms of the kind of the pace of the game, maybe the physicality of the game as much as it in the pro game. But when you're looking at kind of the other commitments that most people have, you know, people have kids, mortgages, families, work, all that sort of stuff, and you're still having to kind of dedicate, you know, 15, 18 hours a week, every week towards rugby. So,
yeah,
it was a soft landing, but it's something that I certainly enjoy doing all the time.
If we fast forward to this year then, and the story of you popping up in the Leinster team when they have a bit of an injury crisis, it's an amazing moment. It was really, really cool to see, especially because your brother was involved on the day as well. Can you talk us through that? How far back that actually goes when you get an inkling, hold on, my professional days might not be totally over here?
Yeah, it was one of those mad situations where I genuinely didn't see it coming. I had no idea. Right. I was kind of fairly under the pump. So the first 3 or 4 years I worked in the bank, and then I moved into financial planning, where I have been for the last 4 years. So I was studying for my CFB exams for 2 years. So for 2 years, it was fairly hectic, where you're working a full-time job, you're playing rugby with Clontarf, and you're studying for a master's to have a qualification. So you're kind of up at 6 a.m. and going to bed 11 at night, you know, 7 days a week for the guts of 2 years, apart from the couple of months off in the summer. So it was one of those things that I was dying for that weekend to come, because it was my last ever exam I was going to sit. Right. And I finished that exam and I was delighted. I was like, listen, I actually get some of my time back now. I actually get to go back and enjoy doing a bit of work, enjoy playing a bit of sport, enjoy seeing your family and friends and kind of spending time with them. And I got a call off Andy Wood, our Clontarf coach. And he was like, listen, you're going to get a call to maybe come in, do a bit of training. I don't really know, you know, what's, you know, entailed, just kind of just giving you a heads up, you'll get a call. And I got a call off Aaron Dundon, who had a quick chat with me just to see if I'd be interested in coming in and just filling in for a week or two with a view that there might be something at the end of it, but with no kind of promises. Like, you might be going to South Africa, you might not be going to South Africa, you might get a game, you might not get a game. So it's kind of one of those where you initially get a bit taken aback by it. And then Leo gave me a call later that day as well, kind of reiterating the same thing. And they asked me to kind of give him a shout by Sunday night. And we had a big game against Conn that Saturday, so I would have had a couple of pints and woke up Sunday morning. I was like, geez, I have to call Leo back and let him know my decision. So I jumped at it. It was one of those things where for the first kind of few minutes I wasn't sure if I was going to go ahead with it, because you're not sure how you're going to fit in terms of the amateur into the professional game. And then also I would have taken so much time off work and the likes in the previous few months, and it was, you know, it was just would have been tricky to commit a few weeks to it on such short notice. But then I rang up my friends and my parents and stuff, and they said, geez, you'd be mad not to do it. So it was something that came completely out of the blue. And then the first game, the debut that I got against Cardiff and the Aviva, I wasn't really meant to be involved that week. It was more a case of you come in, do a bit of training, and then if that goes well, might bring South Africa. We may be giving you a game over there. But Paddy actually went down to training locally, or like unluckily enough for him. I ended up kind of then looking across at Alex and thinking, like, geez, I might actually be in the mix here. But I didn't tell work at that stage. I didn't tell really anyone except for my family, my parents, because I didn't really want to get out in case you don't get played. Then it'd be kind of embarrassing and kind of egging your face stuff. So I was kind of taking half days in work just to kind of get down, do the training, doing the training, then run home and learning all the calls and everything else, which was a bit mad, because like quite a lot of stuff was very similar to what we have in Clontarf, for example, or other teams you play. But it's just more depth of the amount of kind of stuff you have to know, and then also the calls are different. So, you know, you kind of really have to know them, you know, like really, really well to be able to do them under pressure and fatigue. When you don't know them that well, it takes a bit of time to kind of get used to them. So, yeah, it was kind of it was savage. Like, it was a weird enough week because you were trying to just keep everything wraps. You're not really trying to tell anyone you might be playing. You're not then telling anyone you are playing. You're busy learning the calls. You're busy, like, the first day or two in training was a bit of a shock to the system because the sessions are obviously far tougher than what you're kind of used to. They're a bit more quicker. There's a bit more fatigue. They're a bit longer. And even like small stuff that I hadn't been used to in so many years where you actually train in the morning.
Right.
Whereas like when you're playing club rugby, you're training in the evening
so
after.
So nutrition and all that completely changes.
Everything changes. Yeah. How you have your breakfast, how you have your coffee, how you have everything. So they're only little small things that people wouldn't even think about. But when you're kind of going from training at 7 at night to training at 10 in the morning, it just changed kind of everything. But yeah, kind of, I can't be like, I think I've said a good few times, can't really say thanks enough to kind of everyone that was in there, because from kind of the first moment you're in, between the physios, the nutrition guys, the S&C, the coaches, the players, everyone was so kind of welcoming and helpful.
Yeah.
And they made sure you were as up to scratch as you possibly obviously can be. But it's one of those things that's tricky to execute, you know, when you're playing a different level under fatigue over in South Africa.
Definitely. And when you packed down for your first scrum at that level, did you notice a massive difference, or were you pleasantly surprised that actually it wasn't a whole step up?
It was quite tough, yeah. It was one of those things that, like, in training I found it pretty decent, because it's so clean in training. You're trying to work with a jitter to try and get a better outcome rather than trying in matches. Obviously people are always a little bit clever trying to get the upper hand and doing what they're doing. So I actually found training, it was a lot tougher, but it was manageable. But like, it was certainly something that I hadn't experienced before. Like, one of my first scrums was against Rabah Slimani with Orgy's 9 behind him, which is very different. You know, no matter how tough an AL game is, you're not really coming up against that caliber player. But it was something that, you know, I really enjoyed. It was quite good. It was just that bit more physical, that bit more harder. But the first day or two was a massive shock to the system, and then after that, once you kind of get used to it, that's actually the level. It was still just as hard, but it's not really kind of hitting you the same way.
An amazing sort of stamp of approval for the AIL, what you did earlier this year.
Yeah, it was, like obviously there was a fair bit of luck involved on my end. Again, just for the way the guys were
make your own all the time.
Yeah, I can add to say that. But it's one of those things where, like, there's certainly players there that obviously can. It's not myself. Like, I kind of would have went okay in the first game, probably not, like, didn't really play well in the second game when we were way over in South Africa. But it's one of those things where there's a lot of players in the league of various different stages in their kind of careers and sporting careers. And there's been times over the years, been other AL players that kind of stepped up and would have went okay. There would have been other guys that are young guys that would have been playing AL, you know, week in, week out. They might have been in the academy or sub-academy. And after, you know, a season or two in the AL, they get a chance to play for Leinster, Munster, or any of the other provinces. And then they don't really get released back to the AL kind of too much. And like the one that kind of stands out for me probably the most is, I remember the second AIL we won, my first one, when we played against Conn in the final, and Joey Carberry had a ridiculous man-of-the-match performance, and we never saw him again. Yeah. He was getting capped for Ireland against the All Blacks in November, about 5 months later. So it's one of those things where, yeah, like, the AIL's a good league. There, it's a massive opportunity to be a really good breeding ground.
Yes.
For younger players, and it's a massive opportunity for game time, because the one thing I always kind of find is, no matter how much training you do, no matter how fit you are, no matter how much you're kind of look after your nutrition and S&C and everything else, like, unless you're playing matches, you're not getting the same kind of match fitness and you're not getting the same sharpness. So kind of the more minutes, especially at a younger age, like at the age of 31, they probably don't need as many minutes. But if you're 18, 19, 20, 21, 23 years of age, especially as a tight forward, maybe getting as many minutes as you can in a league like the AIL will definitely help your development.
It's an amazing rugby story. People will also know yourself and Alex from the brilliant fundraising work that you've done over the last couple of years as well. Do you mind taking us back to February 2022 when the Russian invasion of Ukraine begins? I know, I'm sure, as a Ukrainian family, this was not a sort of a switch flicking for you guys. This was something that you'd considered, had been fearful of for quite some time. But it's probably when we as Irish people start talking about it as more so than we'd ever done at any time beforehand. What are the shockwaves like in your family, your extended family, when that moment happens in February 22?
Yeah, it was one of those, like you mentioned, there was a fair bit of build-up to it, but it's very strange, because until it actually happens, you don't realise it's happening. And then even when it does happen, it's still a bit of a shock to the system. You feel like you're living a bit of a dream and stuff, where it doesn't feel real. So there would have been, obviously, build-up up to it for a few months. And I remember it actually was February 24th of 2022, so that was a Thursday. And I had training that night, and I woke up at like 4 or 5 in the morning because my phone was going off, and it was a family group saying, listen, it started. And I went onto Twitter, and I think it wasn't Instagram, it was Twitter and something else, and all the videos started kind of popping up of all the rockets flying into airports and kind of everything else. And that just shook me. And I remember I went into work late that day, but I drove home across my family first, just to see them. And we were just busy on the phones, kind of ringing back home in terms of our friends and family who are still over there. My granny, my granny's quite close to where, you know, the kind of the hotspot was.
Whereabouts is this?
In Dnipropetrovsk. Okay. It's on the eastern side.
Okay.
So it was quite close to, it's close to Donetsk. So it's a case of, you're just scared, you're petrified, you're frazzled. Like, you don't really know what's going on. And like, we had, I remember, in a weird way, like in a very strange, peculiar way, the kind of the AIL kind of helped us, because when the war started on Thursday, we trained that night, and we had a big game against Lansdowne on the back pitch in the Aviva. And Woody rang me and he was like, listen, we obviously know what's going on. Not really expecting you and Alex to play tomorrow. No, I know you were due to play, but if you guys want to, you know, pull out, it's absolutely fine. You know, no issues. And we actually decided to kind of crack on and play that game, because for kind of a few hours, it just gave ourselves and our family and stuff just a bit of a break from it. Because it was a very intense 24, 48 hours initially. Like you, over time, you kind of become a little bit used to it. You know, you kind of, it's not as raw as it is at the start. It's still very tough, but it's a case of, like, just for that day or two, like, that match kind of gave us a chance just to kind of switch off from it for even a few hours. So you were still thinking about it before the match, you were thinking about it in the warm-up, you were kind of thinking about it, you know, as the game was starting, but just for those 80 minutes, you were actually able to completely switch off from it. And that's something that will always kind of stand out, and how kind of Lansdowne kind of helped us, and Clontarf helped us, and kind of how the league kind of came together with the fundraiser as well. It was my sister's idea initially. She said, listen, like, there's not much we can do over here, so would something like a GoFundMe page work? And then so she kind of set it up, and then Alex got it moving, obviously with kind of his profile, and we kind of used Clontarf and Belvedere helped us quite a lot, and then obviously spread quite a lot between the other clubs, between the other schools. And, you know, like, I think our target was something like $5,000. That's what we thought max that we would do, and I think it blew past 10 in the first half an hour, so something like absolutely ridiculous. And then for the next few weeks it blew up quite a lot, and then it blew up again the second time for about a 2-3 week period as well. So it ended up doing 75-80k for a children's hospital over there, which was something amazing that, like, you never thought you would actually be able to do.
So this is a children's hospital in Kyiv. You said your grandmother was in Donetsk, obviously, in the red zone there. I presume you had other family in and around Donetsk then as well, or was it just your granny?
No, so it's my dad's side is from Kyiv, and my mom's side is from Dnipropetrovsk, which is quite close to Donetsk, but it's one of those places where they're not a million miles apart. And at the start, especially how quickly the invasion was kind of unfolding in the first few days, you don't really know what's going to happen. Yeah. You don't really know if they're going to be able to overrun the country. You don't really know how your friends or family are going to be. You don't really know you don't know anything. You're just kind of guessing, and you're kind of obviously scared and fearful about the whole thing. And it's one of those things where you kind of feel a bit powerless about the situation as well, because you're over here, safe and sound, but then people you know and family members are in the middle of it. So it was one of those things where, yeah, it was a bit of a blur, being honest, especially the first couple of weeks. You kind of think back about it, but you don't really remember too much of it.
Cause I presume your granny gets out of there.
No, she hasn't moved since.
She's still there.
She hasn't moved. We've asked her, I don't know how many times, to even come over and visit for like a week or two, just take her mind off it. But she's like, listen, I'm 70 odd, 80 years of age. I'm kind of happy enough. Whatever kind of happens, happens. She's very, very religious. So she's, she hasn't been. She's like my friends are here, my family are here. They live a kilometre up the road. I'm going nowhere. So she hasn't actually visited us once since it started. But then it's tricky enough for us because I can't go over.
Of course,
because you won't be able to leave. So yeah, it's a tough kind of situation to be in. But hopefully sooner rather than later it does, finish.
And what's happened to her neighbourhood and all that? Is it like safe? Has there been attacks on her town?
So she lives in a weird enough place where she lives beside one of the biggest train depots in Eastern Europe.
So they kind of need
which
that.
Is obviously a pretty big target for a strike, and then there's a couple of big factories and stuff around her as well. So she lives right in the middle of it. There's been stuff going on around her within a kilometre or so, but thankfully nothing really has happened to her exactly where she lives. But there's been a couple of close calls, so to speak, that are maybe 500-600 meters down the road, but she's thankfully been okay and nothing's happened to her or anyone we know on that side. But it's one of those things that, it's been going on for about, three and a half years now. And it's just as bad now, if not worse, than it was back then. But just obviously the media fatigue and stuff a little bit, because when people are talking about it every day, other things happen. There's been quite a few other big geopolitical events over the last while that probably would have taken, not taking the spotlight, but would have taken some of the kind of distraction away from it.
Actually, that's a really good point. As Irish people, we have the luxury to be able to switch this on and off in our own minds. I'm sure Alex, who was born here, can switch off more than you can, given you were born there. And you can switch off more than your parents can, given they lived a huge amount of their lives over there. How much do you end up talking about it with your parents, for example? Is it one of those things that talking really, really helps, or actually talking just gets you downtrodden and there is this sense of frustration that you have that idea of helplessness coming up again and again?
It's one of those things that kind of probably would have changed a fair bit from kind of start. So at the start, we were obviously extremely worried about everyone and everything happened. We didn't know what was going to happen. So it was kind of a case of we were talking about it 24/7 to each other. We're talking to everyone back home. You'd have your 24-hour news on, back, or obviously the Irish news, and then we'd obviously have the Ukrainian channel and stuff as well. So you'd be kind of watching that, and then after a couple of weeks, you kind of start realising that it's just giving you so much mental fatigue, and it's so draining, and a lot of it is just watching the same thing over and over again, so you're not actually getting any new information, you're just tiring yourself out. So we started kind of capping the amount of time we'd watch the news every day, or start not hard and fast and black and white, but how much we talk about it, because if you kind of talk about it 24/7, it just drains the life out of you, really. So that's kind of what's happened. Then kind of now we'd be in a position where we talk about it every day, but it's not as intense, not as long as you always would, because as you did before, because if you do that, you're just kind of spending quite a lot of time and energy on stuff that you can't actually change as much. You can only kind of change what you can change, and kind of try and put as much time as you can into that, and then just watching the same stuff over and over again just is a bit of a it's a bit of a waste of time and energy, really.
I presume there are family, friends, other people that maybe you would have known as a very young child over there, and certainly people that your parents would have known that have been sent to the front lines.
We do know quite a lot, and actually one of my dad's best friends, he got killed quite recently. So it's one of those things that it's deeply tragic. It's something that's very unsettling. It's something that has hurt us and everyone we know around us, and the fact that you do know the people by first name basis, and you remember those people from when you were a kid, going to barbecues and cinemas and kind of spending time together as families, and you kind of see those people either hurt or unfortunately not with us anymore. It's something that's very, very tough, and something that it's just, it doesn't make you feel good, and it makes you feel even worse the fact that there's very little you can do about it.
Yeah, it must be a really, really difficult thing to, allow to sink in, because thankfully you're not in the middle of it. You do have a bit of a distance from it, but yet you'll be so deeply affected by hearing that news recently, for example.
Yeah, 100%.
I presume it's going to take a bit of time for that sort of thing, especially maybe for your parents, for that to sink in for them, and for that to sink in with you as well.
Yeah, 100%. And there's obviously, you naturally get feelings of the likes of guilt and stuff, that, you know, you're kind of in a position where you're not over there purely by luck, because your parents took a punt 25 years ago to move abroad in search of a better life and ended up staying there. And you're kind of thinking, like, what potentially my life would look like had that not happened, had I been over there now.
That must be such a tempting sliding door thing to consider.
Yeah, and you're kind of just thinking, you know, you do spend a lot of time thinking and overthinking, but it's, again, one of those things that, like, you can only spend so much time thinking about it, because if you think about it all the time, you just got to drive yourself a bit mad by it. But it's something that you do think about every day, and you just do think, what could have happened if you stayed over there? Or you do feel guilty that, you know, just because I'm over here and not over there, I'm safe. You know, you kind of see people you're like your age and the likes that, you know, are in a very different position, you know, in the 21st century, in 2025, that are being sent to, you know, the front line, for example.
The thing is, you say it's hard to know what you can actually do, but you've obviously done quite a lot. When it comes to the fundraising endeavour that you and your brother undertook, I guess it does underline a little bit what being a fairly prominent sports person can actually do, and utilising even just local profile and provincial profile, whatever the case may be, to try and get a few extra quid for a children's hospital in a war-torn country.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of, like, we were very lucky to be part of two very big communities kind of growing up. So from going to Belvedere College, like, Belvedere was some of the best 6 years of my life. Like, I absolutely loved going there, and the connections and the friendships, you may go into Belvedere and then transition to Clontarf. So kind of they were, like, obviously Alex the profile would have helped us massively. My sister kind of set me a page and doing a lot of the background work and the paperwork and stuff for it as well would have been huge. My folks would have kind of helped out with it as well. But the fact that, like, you have two massive communities like that are very helpful, very giving, throwing their kind of weight behind it and trying to use their profile to get it out there, and then that kind of spreads to other schools, that then spreads to other clubs, that then spreads into the radio and the media and kind of a couple of newspapers, and, you know, kind of like other clubs in the IL. But if I remember Con, Ternure, Lansdowne, all these clubs would have kind of given their gates and stuff from the times we played them kind of towards it. You really, would have had kind of other schools, like, so, like, it was just unbelievable to see so many different communities kind of coming together to kind of give us a bit of a dig out. And then obviously when the Leinster lads kind of started trying to get it up and running again for the second time, and then when Alex was over in South Africa, I think he got a man the match against, I think it was the Stormers, and he did an interview, and then that was another wave of kind of that kind of picking up. So it's kind of just the way it happened for us, but it does show the power of sport, the power of community, the power of kind of connections. And it's one of those things where, like, as I said, initially when we're setting it up, we thought, listen, if we get five grand towards it, that'd be savage.
Yeah,
that'll be, you know, we'd be stretching to do it. But again, when you kind of do double that in the first half an hour or hour, I think it does show just how, you know, how far along things that can go.
Were you surprised by the degree of Irish support for the Ukrainian cause in general, not just with regards to your fundraiser?
Yes and no. Like, the thing is, like, I found, like my family, like, we see ourselves as kind of Irish, you know, been here for 25 plus years. But, like, the generosity of the Irish people, not just with this, but we're pretty much everything, is phenomenal. Like, kind of any time you've, you know, joined a sports club or joined a community or try to integrate into something, like, how you're kind of welcomed with open arms, how people go out of their way to kind of connect with you, how people go out of their way to kind of spend time with you, how you're invited out for, you know, your even coffees at the start and stuff to kind of make you a bit more comfortable. So in a way, you weren't surprised, but just how quickly it did blow up, you were. But it's something that, like my parents would have said in Jesus and stuff before, like the Irish people are probably the most generous people in the world, and they're most welcoming, they're the best crack, and, you know, probably the best people to have a pint with and stuff as well. So it's one of those things where a party was surprised, but how quickly it took off and how big it got. But then the other side, he was like, that was nearly always going to happen, just because how sound the country is.
Last question.
Yeah.
Are you praying, you know, for... No, actually, that would be a very callous question. I was going to say, are you praying for, like, some sort of injury crisis? Is there a chance that if there were to be, unfortunately, a terrible injury crisis that rips through the Leinster pack again this season, that we could see you in blue once more?
It'd be fairly unlikely, but geez, you couldn't say no if it ever came up. Yeah. You know, it's kind of one of those where I say there's a 0.01% chance of it ever happening. Okay. But if it did, you know, if somebody ever was stuck for a game, you know, you'd be able to do it. But it's fairly unlikely. As I said, I'm 31 now, a bit older, but, like, the body's still feeling pretty good. I'm just back to, again, enjoying rugby with Clontarf again, enjoying having my time back with no exams, kind of enjoying my job and stuff. So yeah, I'd never say never, but it's fairly unlikely. But if it did happen again, it'd be probably very similar to what I did last year, where I think about it for 5 minutes and then go, listen, what are you doing? You're going to have to do it.
Ivan, it's been a pleasure spending some time in your company. Thanks so much for being so generous with your time. You've been listening to Ivan Soroka, Clontarf and Leinster star of the last 12 months. This has been Settle In with thanks to Guinness 00. Thank you, Ivan.
Owen, thanks a million. I really appreciate it.
Settle In
on Off The Ball,
brought to you by Guinness 00.